NATO is only relevant so long as the United States is, you know, participating fully. Without the United States, there simply is no NATO. They have no military power. There's different ways to measure the reality of this, but one only has to take a look at the difficulties that the various national contingents had in creating these reinforced battalion-sized battle groups that were sent to the Baltics and Poland. Germany literally had to cannibalize its entire armored force to come up with a battalion's worth of serviceable tanks. France, for all of the money they spend on their military and such, when they shipped 5,000 French soldiers to the Sahel a couple years ago as part of their counterterrorism operation, again, they had to cannibalize to beef up regiments to be full strength. And then they needed the United States to fly them in and to sustain them logistically. And the British are just pathetic. It gets worse each year. I mean, I feel sorry for the British almost because, they have this noble military history where, you have these units with storied pasts that fought at Waterloo and they fought, in World War I and World War II and Korea and, this proud. And then what happened is they just began combining them. And combining them and combining them. And eventually you got to the point where it was just too ridiculous. And so they had to start saying, you're done. That unit will no longer exist, And nobody's joining the British military today. They have a recruitment problem. The quality of the soldier is horrific. There's not a single military, I'd say, other than the United States. I'll give Turkey. Turkey does have some serious forces. They do train their forces, very well. And but Turkey's in Turkey, and only one corps of the Turks are dedicated to NATO. The other corps have internal missions or are on the borders in the Eastern District, opposite from Syria, etc. So. NATO simply doesn't have viable military strength. And that means that in order to be relevant, you need the United States. And it's more than just the militaries. NATO is a secretariat. They have a secretariat. They have a civil part. They have a military part. They have this investment part that have significant budgets. And like anything, I mean, I always tell people about when I was a weapons inspector with the United Nations in Iraq. When we first started, I mean, we were lean and mean. We, because we honestly thought that we would be unemployed in 6 months. So we were going to go, pedal to the metal for 6 months to get this job done. And then we got extended another 6 months. Okay, that's no problem. But the problem is after you get extended for the third 6 month, you're like, well, maybe I shouldn't be working out of a shoebox sitting on a empty beer can. We might want to get a desk, and we might want to get chairs. And my files should be in something other than stuffed. Here, I need a filing cabinet. Now we need infrastructure. So now we have an office space. And the problem with an office space, then you need a secretary who's got to manage the phone calls and all this stuff. And next thing you know, you're soft. You've gone soft. I did my best to avoid going soft by continuously being in expeditionary mode, but that's a difficult thing to do for 7 straight years. Eventually people want to come back, be home for the holidays. So instead of planning inspections, you're planning holiday vacation cycles. Who's going to be here? Who's going to do this? And I got a wedding coming up. You never talk about weddings coming up the first years because you were talking about how I can get back to Iraq to finish the job. I'm going into Iraq. I got to go do this, that, and the other thing. But now it's like, no, well, we can do this. NATO became soft. It stopped. Look, during the Cold War, NATO was a hard-ass organization. They were ready, combat ready at the drop of a hat. Four deployed, constantly training, Ask the American soldiers that served in the 11th Cavalry Regiment or the 5th Cavalry Regiment on Fold a Gap or the other. You know, they woke up every morning in combat mode. They went to the field in tanks that had the operational loadout. They were there ready to receive the invasion every single morning. Their job was to be the screening force. The helicopters that flew along were fully loaded, loaded for bear, because if some came across, they had to engage now. We had Air Force units that were on strip alert. The planes were loaded out with pilots in them, ready to go right off the bat. And we did this for a long period of time. NATO was a hungry organization because it was ready for war. And then peace broke out and NATO forgot how to fight wars, or at least forgot how to prepare to fight wars. And they became the garrison. And instead of being out there ready to fight, the tanks stayed in and were getting maintained. But then the budget comes in. You can't maintain them because you're not using them because you're not training. Well, there's no reason to train. Why do I want to go to the field on Easter holiday? I want to be home. We're playing Easter egg hunt instead of in the field ready to fight. And NATO got soft. And then what happens with a soft organization? You have to find things for people to do. And so they start to create the NATO Logistics Sustainability Organization. And it becomes a jobs program. And so, you know, now Europe starts flooding this with the jobs program. And who's paying for it all? Uncle Sam. We're paying for the whole thing. And it's a jobs program. And here's the fatal mistake NATO made. The fatal mistake wasn't going to Afghanistan. That was an embarrassment. The fatal mistake wasn't pivoting to the east. That's just stupid. The fatal mistake was getting involved in American politics. You see, in this campaign that took place this past fall, NATO put their thumb on the scale and said, we don't want Donald Trump. And they began to articulate in support of Kamala Harris, in support of the Biden administration against Trump. Now, that could be forgiven, maybe. I don't know. I'm not Donald Trump. Can't speak for him. But then Trump won the election, and NATO started conspiring with the Biden administration to undermine Trump, to Trump-proof their policies. NATO is the enemy of the United States of America. Let there be no doubt about that, that within the Trump administration, they know who the enemy is, and it's not Russia. Russia didn't interfere in the election. Russia didn't put their thumb out there. Russia didn't conspire against Trump. NATO did. Every single one of these leaders, Emmanuel Macron, Keir Starmer, I don't know if Starmer was, may not have been there, but that, because the British keep changing out their prime minister. But the point is, NATO is the enemy. The Secretary General, Stoltenberg and now Rutte, the enemy. They are literally the enemy of the United States. And so the United States isn't going to fund it anymore. And they're going to leave NATO on their own. Europe has to decide what they're going to do. What you're going to see when the United States withdraws these funds, that the civil budget is going to be slashed. There's going to be a whole bunch of fat Europeans who are used to getting up in the morning and coming in to get their coffee at the NATO cafe, then sit in their office and read the newspaper, and then go out to lunch and have some beer, and then come back and maybe hit a couple letters on their keyboard, and then, oh, I've got to go home early, and repeat, rinse and repeat for 6 months straight. They don't do anything. They're going to lose their jobs because they don't matter. NATO is dead. This is the death of NATO. NATO will never recover from this. Essential thing here, too, is that Europe's going to try to hold on to NATO for too long. If Europe was smart, they'd just shut it down right now. Just shut it down and say, okay, we're going to build a European security agency. But they're going to try and hold on to NATO. And they're going to bankrupt themselves doing this so that when the time comes when they have to step up to reality and say, well, we need a European security agency, they won't be able to put that one. And by that time, the European Union will be dead, because that's the other thing that happened. Donald Trump declared war on the European Union because they're the enemy too. Europe is the enemy of America. And if they're shocked, they're like, what do you mean? We've always been your friend. No, you were the friend of Joe Biden and the establishment. There's a revolution taking place today. It's against the establishment. And the president is Donald Trump. He's going to be president for 4 years. You forgot that when you tried to stab him in the back. And it's all over right now. It's the end of NATO, and it's the end of the European Union, and the collapse is going to come sooner rather than later because these are not strong institutions. If we go back and look at the history of what the Trump peace plan was supposed to be, look at Keith Kellogg's paper that he wrote back in April of last year, and we take a look at the variety of data that's been leaked to the press. One of the key aspects of any peace plan was the concept of a frozen battlefield, and that basically this peace plan would lead off with a ceasefire to freeze the battlefield in place. Here we are, well into the negotiations that are taking place. There's no talk whatsoever of a ceasefire. Nobody's talking about it. You hear some peep out of Europe and in Ukraine, but Russia's not talking about it. America's not talking about it. And I believe the answer is obvious because it would be very difficult for Russia and the United States to engage in serious peace talks. And I'm talking adult level peace talks. Right now, as things stand, if I were the American negotiator, I would turn to the Russians and say, "You're giving up the right bank of Kherson. Sorry, you don't own it. You gave it up. You lost it. And now you can't tell me right now that you want it back because you haven't earned it. You're not there. We want this peace talk now. You lost it. Das Vidanya." And I would also tell them, "You ain't getting Zaporizhia back either. You've had 3 years to capture it. You haven't." We might be able to make some exchanges of territory to give you Donetsk and Lugansk. We understand that the Donbass is important to you. No, you're losing Kherson and you're losing parts of Zaporizhia that you don't have because you don't own it. It's not yours. You don't get to have a referendum and take control of territory that you don't own. So tough noogies. Now, that's a realistic negotiating position, but it's not going to work. But what it means is there won't be peace. All right. So now I'm the United States. I can't go to a negotiating table in good faith and tell the Russians, "Yeah, we're going to give you the right bank of Kherson, all of Zaporizhia and all that. We're going to give you everything you want," when they haven't earned it. So one way to deal with this is not to deal with it. And you just say to the Russians, "Let's start with the basics. We're going to start with rebuilding diplomatic trust and connectivity." And that's happening. I think tomorrow they're meeting in Istanbul to begin the process of re-upping the embassy. The Russians are going to soon have 400 more diplomats showing up in Washington, D.C. to get their staff up to place. The UN mission is going to be brought up to speed. The San Francisco consulate up to speed. Houston, up to speed.
Seattle, me here, all right? Seattle, please. Can I go to Seattle consulate?
I'm sorry, Andre. I was talking to the Charles de Affairs, and I said, if you got to sacrifice one consulate, Seattle. you're right. Seattle, too. The thing is, we're talking about full-spectrum diplomacy, all right? And that's an essential first step. You can't talk about comprehensive peace plans that have so many different components taking place if we don't have the mechanism to discuss. The way diplomacy works is State Department, the Secretary of State and Lavrov get together and they do a big picture thing. Then they pass it off to a number of deputies who then, down to the assistant deputy, then the assistant, then a deputy assistant, deputy assistant, and down to division head and then the assistant division head. And then you have the desk officer and the assistant desk officer. And each one of them have, in the old days, it was a Rolodex. And they'd sit there and their job was to sit there until somebody went, "Ritter, yes, sir, call your counterpart in Moscow and find out what the hell's going on in Khabarovsk dealing with the blue Karner butterfly infusion situation." "Sir." "Hey, Vladimir. Yeah, it's Scott. What the hell's going on in Khabarovsk with the blue Karner butterfly? My guy's biting my ass. Oh, Scott, this is what's going on." See, the connectivity. And we had all of that connectivity and we knew who to call. If somebody came up to me and said, hey, we have a problem with X, I'd go, I got that guy in my Rolodex. I met him at a conference. We were at a cocktail party. I know this guy. We don't have any of that today. Today we have people sitting there. There's no connectivity. There's nothing much. So you can't even begin the process of a comprehensive peace plan that's going to require all of this connectivity until you build the connectivity. So the first thing is get the diplomacy back in place. This is going to start tomorrow. Staffs are going to move in. This is going to take a week, 2-3 weeks to get things back up to speed. Agreements done, furniture put in, heat turned back on, make sure the water works, you know, because they've been mothballed for a while. And we're going to be doing the same thing in Russia. We're going to be bringing our people in and getting things up to speed. All right, then once we have it, then you have to exercise the muscle. It's like going to the gym. You got to work out a little bit, get the exercise, and now you're ready to have the talks. In the meantime, Russia takes Pokrovsk, maybe punches through into Dnipropetrovsk, starts taking territory in Dnipropetrovsk, outflanks Zaporizhia. The Ukrainians withdraw. Zaporizhia's there. Maybe the Russians get a foothold across the Dnieper River into the right bank of Kherson and establish themselves, get up north of the Kherson city, maybe get the Ukrainians to flee because they have nothing left. And next thing you know, that territorial issue that used to be a big deal ain't a big deal anymore because now the Russians own everything. And I think that's why, because to me, the showstopper, and you hear that today, you know, because it's so obvious. You can't have a meaningful discussion with the Russians about terminating this conflict and say that Ukraine doesn't get to keep the right bank of Kherson. It's a non-starter because they own it. If Russia wants it, take it. But you haven't taken it. And so why do you want to engage in that conversation when you know it's going to fail? So you hold off having that conversation. And the thing I know I shouldn't read in the comments, but you know, people are out there saying that, you know, this mineral thing is just farce. It's a fake. You guys, I think you're wrong. I think this is the most serious, comprehensive and consequential aspect of this peace agreement. Russia has rare earth minerals worth trillions of dollars. And yet every year Russia has to import rare earth mineral finished product. Why? Because Russia can't get them out of the ground. They don't have the technology. They have very limited capacity to take this stuff up. They need the United States to come in and pull this stuff out of the ground to help them. That's why Putin put that offer on the table, because Putin knows he's sitting on $7 trillion, but he can only pull it up $10 billion at a time. Meanwhile, Russia's paying China money to bring in finished product that Russia has. There's no reason for Russia to be importing these rare earth metals when it's right there in their ground, but they can't get them out of the ground. The United States can. The other thing this does is it gets the United States and Russia in big time economically. We're talking about, you know, in the past, it used to be about oil. You know, when you dealt with oil, you're talking about scope and scale, and it links you. This is the equivalent of that. The amount of money that we're talking about here is, again, trillions of dollars over time. This brings the United States and Russia together. Now, let's take what the United States and Zelensky are getting ready to sign on Friday. It gets the United States linked in with Ukraine. Now, if we want to talk about a post-conflict, I've had lots of conversations with Ukrainian diplomats and politicians who are in Russia today. And they say that a key element of a post-conflict resolution is a Ukraine that is linked economically to Russia. Well, here we have, because this is a comprehensive deal. It deals not just with rare earth minerals with Ukraine. It's about oil, gas, anything coming out of the ground. The United States is there. The United States and Russia, there's the connectivity right there. This is your security guarantee. See, there won't be any troops on the ground in Ukraine. But it's difficult to talk about security guarantees. If you say, I'm not going to allow any troops on the ground, then what are you going to do to guarantee the security of Ukraine? And if nobody has an answer, Trump has come up with the answer. I think Trump's a hell of a lot smarter than people give him credit for. And I think he has better advisors than people give him credit for. I think he has a genius advisor in Steve Witkoff, who has done tremendous connectivity with probably one of the smartest guys in Russia, Kirill Dmitriev, who knows more about Russia's economy and how Russia's economy deals with sanctions and what needs to be done to get the Russian economy up and running. And I think the entire approach that Trump is taking is to get out of the business of defining problems from a military standpoint, so you need a military-type solution. See, if you view the Ukrainian issue as a military problem, then you need troops on the ground for security guarantees. But if you redefine the Ukraine issue as an economic issue, you don't need troops for security guarantees. What you need is economic interconnectivity. And that's the direction we're heading with this rare earth mineral deal. And I think that's what's happening. And that's going to take some time to finalize too. But you get diplomacy, you get the security guarantee mechanism, and now you sit down and you end the war. The last thing that's going to happen in this conflict is the ceasefire, because that ceasefire will come in when Russia gets all the territory it needs to get to bring this thing to an end. That's my take. We know for a fact that the Russians take accountability serious, because they've already held so many Ukrainians to account. In the Danish parliament earlier this week, there was a standing ovation given to a literal Nazi who had been taken prisoner during the Battle of Mariupol, the defense of Azovstal, found guilty in a trial in Moscow of murdering civilians, sentenced to a very lengthy prison term. But then part of the exchange that got back the man who might be the next president of Ukraine, a Ukrainian politician whose name begins with an M.
Medvedchuk.
Yeah. I didn't want to give it a shot because I knew I was going to butcher it. So thank you, Andrei, for stepping in. And
us Canadian hockey team, half of them are Medvedchuk, Skachuk.
All right. So the Ukrainian hockey player who might be king, just be the president soon. But you know, they needed to get him out and get him back to Russia. So they made this exchange. It was very unpopular in certain circles at the time.
Yeah.
But you know, the West hasn't picked up on the fact that there have been trials and these people have been found guilty, and there are a significant number of people who have been imprisoned for a very long time in Russia. So accountability is a factor, but you know, Russia is going to have to come up with a list of priorities when it comes to this negotiation that's going to take place. I believe that Russia has already made a decision that if there is a chance for a peace that gives Russia most and is close to all of what Russia wants out of this conflict, then Russia should take that chance, that they're not going to fall on their sword for important yet peripheral issues. Because we are talking not just about the conflict in Ukraine, we're talking about a resetting of U.S.-Russian strategic relationship that will resonate far beyond this conflict. And you know, there's a lot of people talking about how, you know, Trump is going to pull a Kissinger 2.0 to try and split Russia away from China. I don't see that happening. I see Trump actually talking about the need to have sound economic relations with China and Russia, which means you acknowledge the fact that Russia and China are economic partners, and that, you know, that rather than split them, I think Trump's going to seek to become a sound business partner to both under the concept of keep your enemies closer, or keep your friends close, but your enemies closer. And so, you know, these are the directions. The European security framework, you know, how important. We know that was very important to Russia. They put draft treaties out there. So, you know, if there's a chance for a European security framework, which might result in NATO disappearing and the European Union disappearing. I mean, this is a gift from God to Russia, a strategic gift there. How much is Russia now going to fall on its sword for trials? There will be trials. A lot of trials can be held in absentia, and et cetera. But you know, the idea that Russia is going to say no, we're going to give up the chance for strategic relationship with the United States. We're going to give up a chance for European security framework. We're going to give up all this stuff because we want to put somebody on trial. I think there's the point I'm trying to make is I think there's a little bit more flexibility in this issue. But now we come down to the crux of things. And this is where the negotiations are going to get interesting. Because Russia has made, there were originally three strategic objectives out of this conflict, and a fourth one has emerged. First one is Ukraine will not be a member of NATO. They got that already. It's already done. They haven't even signed a deal, and that one's finished. Victory for Russia. A more tricky one, demilitarization. You know, what does that mean? I think Russia can make a case that links demilitarization with no NATO in Ukraine. Therefore, any aspect of NATO that's in Ukraine, whether it be training, equipment, etc., must be removed from Ukraine. And that could become the definition of demilitarization. I think Russia wants to take it further and reduce the number of troops that Ukraine's allowed to have. But this, you know, now we're getting into, you know, difficult aspects. And then denazification. And this is the ultimate. This is the very, very tricky one. Because denazification will require a new Ukrainian government with a new leadership that is not just willing, but able to rewrite the Constitution, rewrite the basic laws, to outlaw the right-wing political parties, the ultranationalists, to criminalize what they do, to denazify Ukraine. This isn't going to happen. See, there's a lot of people right now going, okay, the war is going to end, and then the Zelensky or whoever replaces Zelensky is going to be the head of this sovereign Ukrainian nation that we're doing business with today, with a parliament and all this stuff. I don't think that's the way post-conflict Ukraine looks. I think post-conflict Ukraine is a completely different system where a Russian-imposed government has to be in place to give Russia the security guarantees it needs. And Trump has alluded to this. He says, we want a peace that is a lasting peace. We don't want to just stop the fighting and have it come up and percolate to the top down the road. And so these are some of the trickier issues about denazification and how much latitude Russia is willing to give up, because it's an important point. If you don't denazify, Ukrainian nationalism will just manifest itself again, 6 years down the road, 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road. And this war doesn't. And for people to say, well, 20 years is a long time. Not really. We invaded Iraq illegally 22 years ago. Okay. And yet for many people like me, it was just yesterday. So we can't be sitting here going, well, that 20 years, we don't have to worry about that. It's tomorrow. So you need to solve the problem today. Then the last issue that's going to come up is the new territories. Not who occupies them. It's clear Russia will occupy these territories, but their status. Russia is not going to accept the notion that Ukraine is temporarily giving up these territories, that Russia is occupying them, but nobody recognizes this occupation, and this is a problem that Ukraine will resolve down the road. That means by war. So again, you're just creating this situation. So Russia is going to be seeking a treaty where the West and Ukraine acknowledges that Crimea and the four territories of Novorossiya, Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Luhansk are part of Mother Russia now and in perpetuity. It will never change. So these are the elements that have to be negotiated. How do I say this? I think that Trump has been getting some very good advice on Russia lately. To give you an example, the Kellogg plan made no mention of diplomatic reconciliation between the United States and Russia. None whatsoever. But anybody who's been studying this has said that's actually the first thing that has to happen. And one of the first things that came out of the phone call and the meeting between Rubio and Lavrov and others in Riyadh was the absolute necessity of the reestablishment, the priority placed on reestablishing. And it's not just that, but how the United States went about doing it. We're going to return the Maryland properties, the San Francisco properties. We're going to bring dignity back to the Garland. You and I were at the embassy. Okay. I've been going there for a while. The Russians were deeply offended, insulted by how the Russians are adults. They live in the adult world and they understand, you know, the tit for tat reductions and all that stuff. Not a problem. The crude nature of the way we implemented this, the way the FBI just came in and just was crude and rude and the whole thing, it insulted the Russians. Their feelings were actually hurt. And we can pretend that that doesn't matter, but it does matter, especially in the world of diplomacy. And the fact that it's not just to reestablish diplomatic relations, but doing it in a way that repairs the damage is so important. Somebody's giving Trump brilliant advice. And I think they're giving brilliant advice on a whole bunch of other things that are influencing behind the scenes discussions on the pacing of these peace talks and how they're going to take care of this, this way, this way, this way. I don't think things are happening in random chaotic isolation. I think things are happening sequentially, part of a broader plan that we aren't privy to that will, when everything comes together in its culminating moment, allow a peace plan to be signed that is bulletproof. It can't be attacked from you know, a variety of angles. So I know I'm not supposed to read the comments, and I know I'm being criticized heavily for being overly optimistic. And you know, that's fine, except I've never been accused in my entire life of being overly optimistic. I've been accused of the one thing, you know, from the president of the United States on down to battalion commanders, I am the pragmatic guy. I am the realist. I'm the one that puts forward fact-based analysis that connects the dots and just lays the reality out there, you know, right in front of you. That's how I've always operated. And I have a pretty good track record. So this isn't about being optimistic. This is about me stepping back and pragmatically connecting the dots and going, there's a pattern here. I'm seeing things. And it leads me to these conclusions that happen to be positive in nature, pointing us in a good direction. I just want to remind people before I turn this back over to Andre, I've been talking for too long. If the other side had won the election, we would be in a nuclear war this summer and we'd all be dead. I just want to put it out there for people. If you want to ask your question, why does Scott Ritter have a smile on his face when he talks about this? Because I'm going to live. We're all going to live. We ain't going to die. There's not going to be a nuclear war. And if that doesn't put a smile on your face, nothing's going to put a smile on your face. So I'm pragmatic, but I'm cheerfully pragmatic because we ain't going to die in a nuclear war right now. We're talking about peace. 6 months ago, nobody here could have predicted where we are today. Even Garland and I, when we would talk about what it could look like, we never imagined it would look like this. Things are happening at a pace and a scope and a scale that are just mind-blowing. Forgive me for being a little bit optimistic because some pretty cool things are happening that are leading us down the path towards peace. Peace. Not war. If Donald Trump went there as the leader of the United States, celebrating the defeat of Nazi Germany together with their wartime ally that and recognized this as the reemergence of the common purpose that existed back then to package it this way, and to put a new world spin on it was Xi Jinping. See, Donald Trump has an ego. I mean, and the idea that Xi Jinping is going to stand there with Vladimir Putin in this thing that's going to be just as huge. You know, I was there 2 years ago. I didn't get to go to the May 9th one because they didn't know if they were going to hold it because of Ukrainian drone attacks. Remember on May 3rd when that Ukrainian drone hit the Kremlin? But I got to go to the full-scale rehearsal on May 7th. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the event of events. This is the military parade of military parades. This is as emotional a moment as it gets. And what's going to happen on May 9th this year is going to be orders of magnitude greater than what happened on May 7th. We are talking about a celebration to end all celebrations. I hope I get my passport back, and I hope they let me go so I can see it again. But I'm not holding my breath because Xi Jinping's going to be there and everybody else is going to be there. It's going to be the hottest ticket in town, which is why Donald Trump may very well end up going. Because he's not going to miss the opportunity to be here. Now, I think if he goes, though, they need gestures. I think Pete Hegseth has to go at the head of an American military contingent that marches in the parade. That, you know, Trump just can't go there as a tourist. There has to be the grand gesture.
Yeah.
And I think having Donald Trump, the commander in chief of the United States military, standing next to Vladimir Putin, not admiring a Russia parade, but admiring a parade where American troops are participating as allies of Russia. Guys, I'll be sobbing my eyes out if that happens. That would be just an emotional moment like you wouldn't believe. And Donald Trump could very well do this. I do think we need to have a completed peace agreement at that point in time, and we need to have a completed framework, and maybe at least something that can be signed. I think one of the things that could bring Donald Trump over there is to attend the parade and then sit down with Putin and sign the deal, and then sit down with Putin and Xi and have a three-way summit on, you know, doing things, and to walk away with this tremendous diplomatic show. So the more I talk about it, the more I'm talking myself into it. I started by thinking there's about a 20% chance. I'm talking myself into this, Garland. So
51, you go 51 with me?
I'm going to go even higher at this point in time.
0.8.
Yeah, but it's...
Oh, there you go. Yeah. I just calculated it.
We'll see, man. We'll see. They need to have a... You can't put the cart before the horse, though. You need to have a completed peace agreement, and that's not in the bag yet. That's not in the bag.